cash, every movie costs $2,184.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Backtracks Theme Music. My name is Corey Morissette, and joining me, as always, is my good buddy and movie pal, John Mariano. How you doing, John?
I want to suck your blood.
Thank God you said blood. That's right. We're talking about one of cinema's most famous characters, Dracula, and specifically Bram Stoker's Dracula, released
Oh,
sorry.
Oh, hold the phone. So you're glad that I said blood and not dick.
Right.
You're calling him Bram Stoker.
That's his name.
No, his name is Bram Stoker.
Did I say Stroker?
Bram Stoker.
Threw me off.
Bram Stoker is a much different movie than the one that we're about to talk about.
I was thinking Stroker Ace with Burt Reynolds.
No, you weren't. You were thinking about how erotic this film actually is.
It's a little bit erotic.
It's got some moments.
It's got some moments. Monica Bellucci specifically. But we're talking Bram Stoker's Dracula, released in 1992, directed by Francis Ford Coppola. I hadn't seen this movie since probably 1992. I just rewatched it on the weekend at Johnny's behest. What are your favorite vampire movies? Is that fair to say?
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, this film eats a lot of shit because of the sets that was done on a soundstage. It eats some more shit because of the casting of Keanu Reeves that takes a large swaths of the audience out of the movie. Gary Oldman, one of the finest actors, not only of his generation, but one of the finest actors of all time, dare I say, takes on the legendary role of Dracula. And for my money, with all of the great actors from Christopher Lee to Bela Lugosi and everyone in between that have played this role, up to and including Nicolas Cage, who's just conquering it now in theaters, Gary Oldman's my Dracula.
Did you have the Bela Lugosi Dracula? Do you have a lot of history with that one? I know you're a little bit older than me, but you're not quite that old. Did you watch the Lugosi Dracula a lot?
So I have vivid memories as a child that my parents had a Halloween party with their friends. And one of the channels, back when we only had like six channels here, one of the stations ran an all-day movie marathon of the Universal Movie Monsters. And I have had an affinity for all of them since I was young. Like, that's my first MCU. My first Avengers Assemble is Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, where all of the Universal Movie Monsters, you know, they recast Boris Karloff. Somebody else plays Frankenstein in that movie.
But was Lon Chaney Jr. in that one?
Lon Chaney Jr. is in that one. Bela Lugosi's nice. In that one. Who plays the Invisible Man as well?
Dead Better, can't see him.
They're all in it. Yeah, no, you can't see him, but you can certainly hear him.
I guess, yeah.
But it holds a very special place in my heart. And Bela Lugosi, for many years, for much of my childhood, even when they did the movie The Monster Squad, their version of Dracula is Bela Lugosi's version of Dracula, just slightly modernized.
Mm-hmm.
But this Gary Oldman and what he did with this role, and the way Francis Ford Coppola had this vision of the stages of Dracula, and that he wasn't just one way or another. Like, he was young, he was old, he was demonic. And to me, I've drawn these things because, you know, I draw and I sketch. Mm-hmm. And I used to sit with my VCR on pause. I'd rent the movie from Blockbuster and pause it and draw portraits of Oldman, of you know, the giant bat version of Oldman where he's like naked and I think his dick's hanging out.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, all of that stuff. I just think it's fantastic. What do you think? You just recently rewatched it.
Well, to me, the acting really stands out in a lot of ways. You mentioned Gary Oldman as being amazing. He is. But there's a couple other performances that are on the opposite end of that spectrum that are also standouts. One notably by a Canadian icon, legendary nice guy, tremendous actor, Keanu Reeves, who's maybe a little bit miscast as one Jonathan Harker. Let's talk maybe a little bit about his legendary performance.
No.
Okay, we're done then.
No, that's the show. That's the show. We're done. No, I don't know. Like, what was your take on it?
It's very bad. It's Bill S. Sorry, he's Ted Theodore Logan. I always get those mixed up.
Yeah.
It's Ted Theodore Logan trying to do a British accent, and it does not go well. It's worse than Kevin Costner in Robin Hood.
It's funny because I believe, what was the movie he did with River Phoenix?
Oh, gosh, I remember that one too.
But I believe it was that movie that Coppola had seen that made him think he could pull this off. And Coppola also, at the time, was looking for this matinee idol where the girls would all swarm to him at the, you know, at the airport and stuff. Like, almost think of it like a Beatles-like kind of thing. And Keanu had that in this moment.
Yeah.
He was very much that heartthrob on the cover of all the magazines. Not that he isn't now, but he was having a moment out at this time, you know, because of Point Break. And I don't know the timings of releases, but like that ship was starting to really pick up steam. He hadn't done Speed yet, but you know, there was trajectory he was on, and Coppola recognized it and said, "I need this guy in my movie to be my heartthrob because he's acting against one of the most iconic or the most iconic villain in movie history." Right. Yeah. And you have to understand that the power of Dracula is that he can allure, you know, young Mina away from even the most beautiful man. Like, that was kind of Coppola's reasoning behind the casting.
Didn't quite work. Young Keanu Reeves at the time. First of all, the movie you're referencing with River Phoenix was My Own Private Idaho, released yes. in 1991. But Keanu at this point in 86, he did a hockey movie called Youngblood with Rob Lowe. He was in Dangerous Liaisons, which I didn't even know he was in that. Then Bill and Ted.
Ryder.
That's right. And then Bill and Ted, the first one, came out in 89 along with Parenthood. 1990 was I Love You to Death, which is a movie that should have worked, but somehow didn't. And then 91 was Point Break, Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, and My Own Private Idaho, leading into Bram Stoker's Dracula.
So who directed, what did you say, The Age of Innocence in there?
My Own Private Idaho?
No. What was the weird one that you were surprised you didn't realize he was in?
Dangerous Liaisons.
Yeah, Dangerous Liaisons. Who directed that?
Stephen Frears.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, I'm trying to see if there's any connection to, like, Coppola's boys, like the Scorseses and yeah. you know, that crew that might have led to this casting, because they were very, for lack of a better word, incestual in like, handing off, like, here's an actor who was great in my movie. Why don't you try him out in your movie? Because, and that's how they would make stars, right?
Yeah. Well, I Love You to Death was directed by Lawrence Kasdan, who yeah. worked quite a bit with George Lucas, who is American Zoetrope with Francis Coppola. So maybe that had something to do with it.
I think you're seeing what I'm talking about now is like, yeah. And I Love You to Death was a fantastic movie that we will probably do at some point.
It's a fantastic premise.
Yeah.
The execution of it, I don't know if it was there.
You might be right.
Well, we'll have to rewatch that one. I haven't seen it at all. I remember being so excited for that one when it came out, and just it kind of fell flat. Okay. It's got Kevin Kline at the height of his powers.
Okay, I'll make you a deal.
Okay,
and look, we don't do this often on this show because we like very unstructured, but I say that we'll do it in back-to-back weeks. We'll do, and we'll have to rewatch both of these movies.
Okay.
We'll do I Love You to Death, and then we'll do a redemption special in case it sucks.
Okay.
With A Fish Called Wanda immediately after.
Please. Oh, yes. A Fish Called Wanda is one of my all-time favorite movies.
Okay. So deal?
Deal. 100%. I Love You to Death. There's a double feature for you. I Love You to Death and A Fish Called Wanda. All right. But let's get back to Dracula, shall we? And Bram Stoker. I'm going to start saying that right. I tell you, Stroker Ace. Stoker really made an impression on me.
Stoker Ace with Burt Reynolds is fantastic.
I love that movie when I was a kid. But we're talking Bram Stoker's Dracula, Francis Ford Coppola, and the song we're doing is by the legendary Annie Lennox. And this is Love Song for a Vampire. It plays over the end credits of Dracula. I don't remember a lot of it because I think I was talking to my wife about the movie as the end credits were rolling. So it's almost kind of like a first time listen for me. Have you heard this song in a while, John?
I've only ever heard it because I always let the credits of this movie play, because I treat this movie as a theater experience every time I watch it. Right. And it's like, I know how you feel about it. I know what takes you out of this movie, but from an artistic standpoint, like, I love the sets. I love that this is the old soundstage attitude of old Hollywood, and the look and the feel of this film, it's a muse to me, right? Like, from the artist standpoint, this entire film is a muse to me. It makes me want to create, because everything in this film is created. You know, not always the best. There are warts, but warts and all, I love it. There's a craftsmanship to it that I don't think we get in cinema today.
I tell you what, the sets reminded me of a Uwe Boll movie. They're very cheap and not necessarily well done, but the costumes, holy cow. Like, they knocked it out of the park with the makeup, with the costumes. There's a lot going on that's really good with Dracula. Sets, I thought, were kind of goofy.
I really think that they used, I had mentioned this to you, I'm pretty sure I saw an interview at some point, and we could debate how much bullshit was in the interview. But I'm pretty sure I saw an interview with Francis Ford Coppola that he wanted to use all of the techniques that were available in 1933 when Dracula was made. And what the logic is behind that or whatever, he brought this movie in with this cast at this time in or under budget at $40 million, and brought it in on time, which for Coppola was unheard of, especially coming off of The Godfather Part III.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you know the story about why he did this movie?
About why Coppola did?
Yeah.
No, please tell us.
So I was just reading it. So Winona Ryder passed on The Godfather III. I'm guessing she was supposed to play one of the kids or something.
She was at Sofia Coppola's role.
Yeah, I believe so. And she passed on it. And as kind of, she had to have that apology meeting that when you pass on like a major director's movie, you have to have then go have like the I'm sorry meeting.
Mm-hmm.
So during the I'm sorry meeting, and it was very ballsy of Ryder. She had fallen in love with the screenplay because of the romance in it, and brought this up to Coppola. And Coppola, in her words, looked like he was going to blow her off and never read it. But then he saw the word Dracula on the cover of the screenplay, and he was intrigued. So then he read it and came up with this idea of, I think I can do it this way, because he's Francis Ford Coppola of Godfather fame and has brought all these big movies and pretty much could do whatever he wants in Hollywood at this stage of his life. So that's how and why we get this. Now, while Dracula might be the most famous vampire, Corey, do you have any favorite vampires or vampire movies?
I was trying to think about that when we were doing this. What would I list as my favorite? I know as a kid, I'd probably say Lost Boys. And that's one I haven't rewatched in a while. And I've been told by a few people that it doesn't hold up. So I'm looking forward to doing the shirtless sax guy song from Lost Boys at some point.
So I like to do this game where it's like, watch this instead of that. Right. And while you have a fondness for the Lost Boys, for my money, the better 80s vampire movie of the same type of tone, and you can watch them like back to back. I recommend this to anybody who's listening right now. Is watch Lost Boys and then watch Fright Night.
Yes, Fright Night. I haven't seen that one in a hot minute.
Yeah, Fright Night. Chris Sarandon in that one is fantastic as the villain, and that one to me still holds up. The effects a little bit cheaper, but I will never slight practical effects for how they were done in their time.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I will take practical effects over digital every day of the week. Vampire movies, I'll rattle off a couple of them, though, some of my favorites to you. I believe we both share a mutual love for What We Do in the Shadows.
Absolutely. That'd probably be my pick right now. I just saw that one a couple of years ago for the first time and absolutely loved it. Taika Waititi, hilarious.
My only knock on it, and it's not really a knock, is that at this stage of the game, the TV show, the spinoff TV show, has far surpassed the movie for me.
Well, I got to watch it.
Yeah. And I still love the movie as much as I loved it the day I saw it. But the TV show is just utterly fantastic. Aside from that, I got to go with Interview with the Vampire. Mm-hmm. I know Anne Rice was not a fan of the Tom Cruise casting. I feel like that's the movie where I realized that Tom Cruise was more than a movie star. Right. And when he took his turn in like Tropic Thunder, when he did some nuttier stuff later in his career, I feel like the first moment in his career where he does something different is Interview with a Vampire. I think he's great in it. And he's not even the best part of that movie. Like Antonio Banderas steals that movie from a super famous Brad Pitt and the height of his powers, Tom Cruise. And Antonio Banderas just up and snakes that movie from them. And Kirsten Dunst is fantastic in her debut role.
You know what? I've never seen that one. I got to get to it. You know what kind of jumped out at me? I don't think a lot of people would mention this one, but Blade 2, I thought was pretty damn good. Guillermo del Toro?
Oh, I'm not. Look, Blade 2 isn't just one of the best vampire movies of all time. It's one of the best superhero movies of all time. Right? It kind of finds this nice niche of being a horror superhero movie, which I appreciate. If you want a smaller movie, let the Right One In, which is an import from I forgot what country it's from, but it's about a little girl who is turned into a vampire. So this whole movie is about this little boy and this little girl who make friends on the playground, but she's only there at night. And let the Right One In is based on vampire lore, that the vampire needs to be invited into your home or into your dwelling. Otherwise, it cannot come in.
That sounds cool.
Yeah, yeah. That's a really fun, intimate, I don't mean intimate like erotic, but like intimate, like a very small vampire movie that really has intense horror. Innocent Blood's another one. I believe she was a vampire. I don't know if she might have been a werewolf in that movie, though. I think it was a vampire movie. I think that's a vampire movie as well. Buffy the Vampire Slayer does not hold up. I've rewatched that fairly recently. The show way better than the movie, but I don't even know if the show holds up as well as it used to. I'll probably take some flack for saying that, but are there any other vampire movies I am missing? Probably. Oh, there is one. And I'm going to make you watch it at some point, and we got to look at what songs are in it. Quentin Tarantino, when he was the hottest thing in Hollywood, teamed with Robert Rodriguez to bring us From Dusk Till Dawn. And Corey, without spoiling the movie, the first, third of that movie, maybe the first half of that movie, is very much a Quentin Tarantino movie. And the back two-thirds or the back half of that movie is very much a Robert Rodriguez movie. And like the two don't meet. Like the tonally and everything else, it works and it doesn't work all at the same time, but it is a fun ride to get there.
Can't wait to watch that one. It just came to me. My all-time favorite vampire movie is Ed Wood. Even though there's no vampires in it, but Bela Lugosi's in it, played brilliantly by Martin Landau. It's one of my all-time favorite movies. I just had to shout it out here.
That's cheap, but I appreciate it.
All right, let's get back to Miss Annie Lennox and Bram Stoker's Dracula. This is Love Song for a Vampire.
Come into these arms again and lay your body down. The rhythm of this trembling heart is beating.
You know, Annie Lennox might be one of the most underrated vocalists out there. You know, not only is this a very haunting, tonally appropriate track for this movie, but I'll give you a little glimpse into how great of a singer she is. When it came time for David Bowie to pay tribute to the late, great Freddie Mercury, mm-hmm. and they were putting an album together, he asked Annie Lennox to do her version of Mercury's vocals on Under Pressure. Right? Which is like, when you think about what that task is, and that she tackles it so well. The opening of this song, I think, is very indicative to the power and restraint of Lennox's voice. She's showing a lot of restraint, but I'm captivated. And this is not my speed of a song at all.
But it fits the film impeccably well, doesn't it?
100%. Like, and especially, like, this is a film where you would picture it being all score and all this. I believe this plays over the end credits.
Yep.
But this song is a mood, and it's the mood of the film. It's not just the tone, right? It's very forlonging of love kind of feeling. There's a melancholy to it, but there's also a little tinge of darkness to it.
All very appropriate for the film that we had just watched at this point.
Musically, it's so funny because when you overlay her vocals over what musically is going on, it almost feels with the pounding heartbeat of what's going on with the drum and just the percussion in general in this song, it almost feels like a storm is brewing around Annie's velvety voice that is, you know, kind of reminds me of the ethereal clouds that form with a storm. This is really, it feels like the calm before a storm.
Mm-hmm. Well, something interesting I thought of was the lyrics here. Once I had a rarest rose that ever designed to bloom, cruel winter chilled the bud and stole my flower too soon. The beginning of this movie is back in the 1400s, Vlad Dracula is in a war with the Ottoman Empire. And as like a final fuck you, the Ottomans send a message back to his beloved at the castle saying that he was killed in battle. And so she kills herself and he returns home to find her dead. And that verse or that section of the song really kind of reminded me of that portion of the film.
Yeah, no, and like to go back to like what this film is, you know, he then gets damned into becoming this eternal demon.
Yeah, he turns his right? back on God. He actually forsakes God and drinks some sort of blood that pours out of the chapel like stone, like out of a chair, and that turns him into a vampire.
Yeah, but it allows him to seek the revenge on his enemies he's looking to seek. But in doing so, he's now damned to carry this tragedy, you know, for all eternity, until Jonathan Harker comes upon him and he sees a picture of Mina Harker, which is a spinning image of like the reincarnation of his long lost love.
Right. Now, you know a little bit about Dracula. Is that the actual origin of Dracula, like the character from the novel? Or
yeah, this is actually very accurate to the book.
Okay.
In a lot of ways, for better for worse, right? Like, it's funny because in high school, and like, excuse my fuzzy memory, but it's been close to 30 years since I've read this book.
You're doing pretty good.
Thanks. And we read Bram Stoker's Dracula and Mary Shelley's Frankenstein back to back. And what I remember is that Bram Stoker's book was very close to this movie. Like, this movie, of all the Dracula movies that had been made, was the closest to being accurate to that story. Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, which they tried to do with the very poorly with the Robert De Niro movie that came
out. That was Kenneth Branagh. Yeah.
That was more accurate to the book, especially in calling the monster Prometheus, things like that. But, you know, if you go back to the Boris Karloff movies, the book is pretty much Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein mashed together. And I will say, if you have a chance to read one of these two books, I know that we are doing this particular movie right now, but go read Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, which is one of the all-time great books of all time. I feel like, look, this is a romance story gone wrong, and we've seen this a thousand times, some better, some worse. I don't know how well Bram Stoker's Dracula as a story holds up for me. I love the idea of the monster of Dracula, but humanizing him the way the book does, I don't know if I'm that interested in it. Where the Mary Shelley book humanizes Prometheus, but demonizes, there is a real villain in the story, and it's Victor Frankenstein.
As it should be, yeah.
Right. And you know, Prometheus is very much a character of, you know, you feel great empathy for. And I don't know that, I feel like Bram Stoker is trying to achieve the same with the very murderous Vlad Dracul. And I think it's very tough, because while you can understand he would want revenge and it sucks that he gets damned, he feels like a far less tragic figure than Prometheus, who had no part in his own existence.
Right. And the movie, I don't think, portrays Dracula sympathetically at all, which I kind of like. So I was interested in reading the book after watching the movie, but now maybe I'll hold off just based on what you were talking about there. I thought the movie maybe portrayed that character a little bit better. You don't want to empathize with Dracula at all.
No, you want Dracula to be this true creature of the night that is menacing. And look, say what you will about this film, Dracula's scary in this movie, right? And he took something that for our generation, our Gen X generation, that was very jilted and like over everything. And he took something from our grandparents, right? Because Dracula had been around since the 30s, right? Longer than that, but like in cinema since the 30s. I mean, you can go back to Nosferatu, but that was always like, well, they did that in the silent movie, Bela Lugosi's Dracula. And we always thought it was, to a degree, corny, like, ah, rise, children of the night. Right? Like, it was almost cartoonish.
Yeah.
And Coppola and Oldman and the makeup department create something menacing and scary. And there's a little bit of, like, in Old Man Dracula, there's a little bit of, like, what Mr. Burns would be like in real life. Like, decrepit and creepy and falling apart old
with
man.
With a big bum hairdo, too. Yeah.
And honestly, if I'm Keanu Reeves and suave man about town Gary Oldman shows up with those sunglasses to pick up my girlfriend, I'd be lost. Like, even if you look like Keanu Reeves, like, you're not holding on to Winona Ryder. Like, that Dapper Gary there is stealing her away 10 times out of 10.
Oh, absolutely. Like, that was probably my favorite version of Dracula he does in this film. He does the old man Dracula with the big bum hair. He does a werewolf almost Dracula. He does a demon Dracula, a bat Dracula, and then young sexy Dracula, which was really, really good.
And the werewolf Dracula, like, raping Lucy is one of the most horrifying horror movie scenes, especially when you wrap your head around what's happening here, and he's taking her and bringing her over to be one of the children of the night and all this stuff, and he's raping her. Like, it's not willing, like, it's supposedly willingly, but it's willingly under a spell.
Yeah.
He basically Bill Cosby's her,
right?
And then turns into this werewolf, and you can see like this true animal taking, you know, Mina's best friend Lucy,
yeah,
and it is horrifying.
It certainly wasn't consensual like it was in the classic Lowell Dean film Wolf Cop.
Correct.
All right. And Annie Lennox did another song about rain with her band. What was that called? Here Comes the Rain Again. Gotta love that song. I was getting real Eurythmics vibes. I just wanted to call that out because I love the Eurythmics, and this section very much Dave Stewart inspired, I think.
I know we very much try not to repeat artists and repeat songs, but I feel like a loophole here is this is Annie Lennox, you know, on her
solo.
Own.
Yeah.
Solo. So I think that we're open to still cover a Eurythmics song at some point, Gordon.
Thank goodness. There's a lot of good ones out there.
So I just wanted to let you know, even my hardest rule on the show has a loophole. And I believe with, you know, requesting to do this song and this movie tonight, you might have tickled my generous bone, like whatever that is. And I feel very, very giving with my generous bone. And I want to give my generous bone to you.
Would you mind tucking your generous bone back in your pants, though? I don't need to see this on the Zoom call.
I will say that we will cover the Eurythmics, and that's thanks to my generous bone that you can see very, very lovingly on the Zoom call right now.
Well, thank you for not Bram Stokering your generous bone. Johnny, do you think this song was nominated for Best Song back in 1994, it would have been, or 93?
I don't believe it was because of the press around this movie. I think it should have been.
You know, this movie was nominated for 4 Academy Awards. It won 3. It was not nominated for Best Original Song. The nominees that year were Aladdin, A Whole New World, The Mambo okay. Kings, Beautiful Maria of My Soul, Aladdin Again, Friend Like Me, I Have Nothing from The Bodyguard and Run to You from The Bodyguard. So 2 Bodyguard songs, 2 Aladdin songs, and 1 from The Mambo Kings. Nothing for poor Annie Lennox.
It's a tough year for it because those, when you look at those soundtracks and what those were, and you know Disney was putting their weight behind it too.
Mm-hmm.
But you're looking at, you know, Robin Williams with A Friend Like Me gets a nomination. A Whole New World was one of the biggest songs in the world. The Bodyguard was the biggest soundtrack, one of the biggest soundtracks of all time, right? And you throw in the Mambo Kings there, and I feel like that's a movie that probably could have had more nominations. I don't know how many it ended up, you know, covering, but I know that at the time there was a lot of buzz around it, but it just wasn't it wasn't going to get over that edge. So I think every nomination that it got, it was probably warranted.
I got to correct you on one thing, though. You Got a Friend in Me is from Toy Story. Friend Like Me was from Aladdin.
What do I know? You think I know movies?
So obviously A Whole New World from Aladdin won that year. Do you know what year Annie Lennox eventually did win the Academy Award for Best Song? This is an easy one.
Is it?
I think so. What movie did she win for Best Song?
I mean, you have the answers in front of you, so this feels unfair.
This one's off the top of my head because I know this because this is easy. Because this film was nominated for 11 Academy Awards and won 11 Academy Awards that year.
11 Academy Awards?
Mm-hmm.
That seems like a lot.
It is. It's tied for the record, actually, with Titanic and All About Eve.
A Titanic level movie?
Mm-hmm.
Can you give me a year?
2003.
I don't know if I went to the movies in 2003. what is it?
Lord of the Rings, Return of the King.
Yeah, that's cheap.
How was that cheap?
Because that movie didn't have songs in it.
It did, though.
No, it was like this movie. It was at the end of the movie.
I know, and she won for it.
That's fair. So it was the Forgive Me Oscar because she deserved it for this one, too.
There you go. It was the Forgive Me Oscar maybe in a lot of ways because a lot of people thought it should have won in 01 Fellowship of the Ring over A Beautiful Mind. But
I say that as a fan. That.
I'm a fan of A Beautiful Mind. I like that movie.
Oh, I am, too. But when you're talking about best movie and what the movie accomplished, there's always been a slight on blockbuster movies. But you know, the way that the Lord of the Rings trilogy was accomplished, and I know that it was like a given that it was eventually going to win for Return of the King,
mm-hmm.
but each one of those movies in their own right were the best movie of their year, whether you enjoy the pacing or not.
You know,
they accomplished so much.
O2 was Two Towers, and what won that year? Chicago? Yeah, I would agree with that. Yeah, O2, Two Towers should have won.
And I'm not knocking the movies it was up against. I'm very glad that they were recognized, right? But when you look at what The Lord of the Rings, what that accomplishment is and that commitment from the actors, everyone basically moved to New Zealand for years of their life
mm-hmm.
To accomplish that. It's something special.
So you're saying after Avatar 5 comes out, it's guaranteed the Oscar for the same reasoning, the accomplishment of it? Or does it still have to be at least halfway decent? Because Return of the King is a good movie. You could say, okay, yeah, they rewarded the accomplishment. It's also good, though. I don't know if Avatar 5 is going to be on that level.
No, but that's part of the accomplishment, right?
That it's good?
Part of the accomplishment is like, it's not just a competent movie, but it's among the greatest of the year. And it has, it's almost like when you take a dive, like let's go back to our Back to School episode, right? The Lord of the Rings trilogy is truly the triple Lindy,
mm-hmm.
right? And while Avatars 2 through 5 might also be a triple Lindy, it's like you kind of stutter or trip on a couple of the boards on the way down.
Did you see the second Avatar? I wouldn't call it a triple Lindy. It's a single at best.
Well, no, I'm saying they attempted the triple Lindy.
Yeah.
Right? That's what I'm trying to get at. And then whatever happens on the way down, it's like, well, they called their shot, and okay, Dangerfield hits straight tens, and you're hitting like fours and fives.
Maybe six. Like, I don't know. I kind of got that vibe this year with Way of the Water, right? It wasn't one of the best movies of the year yet. It was nominated for whatever reason.
Okay, Corey, I just went to one of our favorite websites, songfacts.com.
Mm-hmm.
And Annie Lennox, in a 2009 blog post, talked about her inspirations for the song. And I think we got to talk about this for a minute.
Okay.
So Coppola approaches her that he's making a film about vampires taken from Dracula by Bram Stoker. So while she's looking for inspiration, Lennox goes off. And she reads a book. You know what book she reads?
I'm going to guess. Anne Rice?
Anne Rice. Interview with a Vampire. And she saw a whole other side to vampires in reading that book.
Because I believe, I don't mean to cut you off here, Johnny, but yeah. I think that verse I outlined earlier I'd read actually comes from a poem, I think, from Interview with a Vampire. Jeez, I almost screwed that up.
Oh, that's... That's interesting, but it's funny because tonally, this song really fits both movies. I actually think this song fits this movie better. Had Interview with a Vampire been written tonally more like the book, I think it would have been good for either. But it kind of shows you how the tonal shift in that movie, you know, and where that exists. I love that movie. I spoke about it at the top of this show.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I have a buddy who read all of Anne Rice's novels, and he would talk to me in detail about the distinct differences in that, you know, Tom Cruise's Lestat basically turns into Axl Rose in modern day.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And, like, neither one of us, like, that's where it falls apart for us. Is like, had they done more, and I know they attempted the sequel and they recast it and everything, but had they done it properly, that's where it really starts to fall apart in the casting. Cruise is incredible as like Lestat in older times, but can you picture him playing like an Axl Rose? I know he kind of does that as Stacy Jacks in Rock of Ages.
Right. And it kind of worked. I don't know. What did you think of that performance?
I have so many thoughts on that movie, but a lot of them are colored that I saw the Broadway play before I saw the movie.
Oh, okay.
And while I enjoy the movie, there was a grittiness and a dirtiness. The play feels very much like a Motley Crue video or like, you know, Welcome to the Jungle and like that era, mm-hmm. that grittiness of LA and LA clubs.
Yeah.
And there's a little bit too much sheen to the movie.
Oh, absolutely. Because, like, yeah, you go to the club in the movie, it's not the whiskey. Right. It's not the Cat House or any of those places, right? It's too clean.
Right. Like, you go see the play on Broadway, and this was one of my favorite parts. And if you come to New York, maybe, and if it's still playing, we'll go see it.
Oh, I'd love that. That'd be great.
But one of my favorite parts is they make the theater feel like one of these dive bars, to the point, Corey, I sat in the cheap seats, and the waitresses were selling beer up and down the aisles during the play and like shit talking you as they would be in a dive bar while you're enjoying the play. And the whole atmosphere feels gritty.
Oh, that'd be fantastic. There's another movie we can do. We can do Catherine Zeta Jones singing Hit Me With Your Best Shot.
Yeah.
The incomparable Annie Lennox with Love Song for a Vampire. That's not a song I'm going to be spinning religiously around my house. It's pretty repetitive and kind of a downer, but it fits the movie to a bloody T. No pun intended. So good movie choice, John, and pretty good song, too.
Oh, this was your movie choice, my buddy.
Well, you originally said you got to watch Bram Stoker's Dracula. And so I took your advice and did it. I don't regret it.
What was fun about it was, what spurred that was, I think
yes. Tell them why. There's a movie coming up. Oh, I wanted to talk about this.
Yes, we were watching the trailer for The Last Voyage of the Demeter, which is really about a brief moment in this movie, right? Like you just rewatch it. How long is The Last Voyage of Demeter in this?
It's a montage, maybe 20, 30 seconds. They kind of cut back and forth. Between, I think, Jonathan Harker with Dracula's wives and what's happening on the boat. And you just see kind of like shadows and you see crew members and then the boat shows up and everyone's dead.
Right. And that's pretty much what it is in the book, is that we don't see what happens on this voyage. And now we're getting an entire movie that is basically Die Hard on a boat, but instead of terrorists, it is a boat that was chartered by Dracula. He's going to London to go wreak horror on the Harker family and do all of those deeds, you know, meet Lucy, all the stuff that we talked about, you know, eventually get killed by Van Helsing. All of that stuff is coming. But none of that's going to happen in this movie. This movie is simply about the boat he charters from Romania to London and what happens on that voyage to this crew.
Yep, it's a claustrophobic horror movie, and it looks tremendous. I can't wait for that movie to come out later this summer. But Bram Stoker's Dracula was a big hit when it came out way back in 1992. Do you know what the final total for this movie was?
What death toll?
No, I like playing movie trivia with you. And since you hate Rotten Tomato scores, I thought we'd go with domestic gross. What do you think this movie grossed in 92?
It was a $40 million budget. Say somewhere in like the 180, 190 million range.
Well, actually, domestically, it only grossed 82 million. But back in 92, that was a really respectable number. Worldwide, it grossed 215. So an even better number. Yeah,
I was giving you more what I thought the worldwide number was.
You were very close then. I know it opened at number one, beating Back to the Future 2. It grossed 30 million on its opening weekend, which in 92 was huge.
Yeah, 80 million. Like you look, you know, they always talk about doubling your budget, right? Because whatever you put into your budget, you then put into marketing as well, right? So if it was $40 million to make, another $40 million to market, you're at $80 million. The rule of thumb, it grosses $7 million domestically. So everything it grosses internationally is gravy. Yeah, and that's not counting home video and everything else afterwards.
It was a big hit on home video. But yeah, it grossed 133 internationally. So pretty sizable hit for the studio back in 92. John, is there anything else that you want to talk about in relation to Bram Stoker's Dracula?
Oh, like the one thing that we didn't mention that probably should be mentioned is Anthony Hopkins plays Van Helsing in this movie. And I there's been other versions of the character. I don't know if he's my favorite version of Van Helsing, but I think he's a very appropriate one for this film.
He's chewing all the scenery, which is kind of a nice counterpoint to Gary Oldman's performance. So yeah, I'm with you. I thought he was fantastic.
Yeah. Like this movie gets knocked for acting because Ryder, while she brought the screenplay, to Coppola, might have been a little bit in over her head. She is gorgeous as Mina Harker.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, she does a great performance, but her British accent's a little bit lacking. And Keanu Reeves, look, does his best with the role, and miscasting does happen. But to shame this movie because of it, and to shame this actor because of it, because Keanu at this point in his career starts doing some pretty incredible work.
Yeah.
Right. And he's building towards like the Matrix, and you know, his acting career has probably had like two or three different waves, with like this early 90s becoming an action star with Speed and films like that. Then doing the Matrix and having like a second life of his career, and then eventually becoming John Wick, and now in like the third act of his career.
An absolute treasure of a human being, Keanu Reeves. I'm not going to slander him here. He had the bravery to take on this part. That's more than a lot of actors would say. And like you said, great performances by a lot of it. Richard Grant is in this movie. Cary Elwes is in this movie. Tom Waits, again, chewing all the scenery as R.M. Renfield in the asylum. Fantastic stuff. I really believed he was eating bugs. He was doing a great, great job. And of course, Monica Bellucci, very unforgettable as one of Dracula's brides.
And what's funny is like when you start talking about this cast and everything, right? Keanu and Winona Ryder make several films together. Keanu and Monica Bellucci are in The Matrix together,
mm-hmm.
right? There's a lot of these connections of actors, you know, in other movies acting together that cross paths in this movie, which I think is really cool.
I do too. On that note, John, you got anything you want to promote or let the people know about?
Oh, I guess we could promote a little show we do call the Backtracks Aerosmith Revisited. We do that with our buddy Scott Kahaskin. Scott's got some books out on Amazon if you want to give him a check out. The Universal Court series by Scott K. Haskin. You can just search them on Amazon and buy the crap out of them and leave reviews, for God's sakes. The man needs some reviews to let people know how solid his work is.
And he just wrote two more that you can go check out on his author page on Amazon. If the guy's not busy enough doing podcasts, he wrote two more books just out of the blue. And you can always, as John mentioned, our show Backtracks Aerosmith Revisit. You can catch Scott on there with us. Aerosmith just announced a farewell tour as we record this on a Monday. So that's worth checking out. And so is all the other podcasts on the Deep Dive Podcasting Network. Let's just run through them real quick for you. Of course, myself and what's his name? Mark Kammerer do a little show called End the Podcast Will Rock. Scott does his Uriah Heep Show, The Magician's Podcast. Nate and John at the Deep Purple Podcast. The Simple Man at Skinnerd Reconsidered. Terry T-Bone Mathley at T-Bone's Prime Cuts on the Other Side. Rye at Sabbath Bloody Podcast. Paul, Joe, and David at In the Lap of the Pods. Andy and Matt at Hawk Binge. Eric and Jonathan at Maiden A to Z. Daniel and Josh at Diary of the Madman, The Ultimate Aussie Podcast. Ben and Sam at Universally Speaking, The Red Hot Chili Peppers Podcast. George and Hattie at The Judas Priest Cast. Clay and Ryan at North by South Podcast. Greg and Jonathan again at So Far, So Pod, So What. Kevin Brown at The Tom Petty Project and with his good buddy Randy Woods on Seaside Pod Review. Quinn at In Volume for All. Sav, Nick, Steve, and Mark at The Rock Roulette Podcast. And Chaz and Greg at Regarding Lulu. Also check out our friends Sean McGinnity at the Sean Geek and Fast Fred Podcast.
Hey, Corey, can I ask you a question before we go?
Sure.
When the hell are you and Mark going to have me back on the Van Halen Podcast to mess things up?
You know what? I ask him like every week, should we bring John back? And he never really gets back to me.
That tracks. Maybe one day I'll just show up and annoy you guys.
I think that's the way we're going to have to do it. You have the link to just pop in some night when we're recording.
Yeah, I think that's what I may do.
Sounds good. Look forward to that on End the Podcast Will Rock. But until then, on behalf of John Mariano, my name is Corey Morissette. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you next time on Backtracks Theme Music.
He's lost his greedy mind, poor chap. I want you to take over for his foreign client, this rather eccentric Count Dracula. He's buying a property around London.
Of course, sir. I'll attend to the Count. Thank you for your confidence.
This is a great opportunity for you, Harker. But you'll have to leave Transylvania immediately. Opportunities such as this come but once in a lifetime.
Yes, of course, sir. If I may inquire, what in fact happened to Mr. Renfield in Transylvania?
Nothing. Nothing. Personal problems. Close these transactions, and your future with this firm is assured.